CliffCentral.com.
Yatish, another episode of This Is Us. Today we have someone really interesting joining us. Brian Green is the co-founder and the creative inspiration behind Group 44 Properties in Johannesburg, which of course is the company that focused on urban renewal. This is a very sexy subject in South Africa, in the world actually, at the moment. Urban renewal. We know there was a time where the Johannesburg CBD was just a no-go zone, especially for property companies. They wanted nothing to do with it. And there were a couple of brave and quite visionary people who saw a massive opportunity there. And what Group 44 have done is they've redeveloped vacant and derelict inner city high-rise and industrial areas. They've turned them into highly sought-after retail and commercial precincts. And Johannesburg is really just the tip of the iceberg. But Brian, it's great to have you on. How are you, sir?
Thank you. I'm very well.
Very good, Brian. First of all, all I can say from the point of view of someone who has always thought that the inner cities have a charm about them, there's something very kind of first world about the way you could live in these high-rise apartments and have these beautiful views. And for many people, Johannesburg is not the first place that pops into mind when you think those things. But you guys have been instrumental in developing so many incredible places in Joburg, and I've been to some of them, and I've seen these rooftop bars and these beautiful apartments and these incredible places that you've made. You believe in the city. You believe in urban renewal, right?
Well, I think it's something that I got into by complete accident. But as I got into it, you start kind of exploring the goods, the bads, and the uglies about these things. Mm. And you know, I learned that brownfield development in kind of normally in inner cities is very important to upgrade, because otherwise it just turns into a bit of a hellhole and, you know, it fills with all kinds of nonsense. So it's very important to keep a city alive from its center and going outwards. And that doesn't mean urban creep. It just means keep the city vital from the core going outwards. And I fell into it by complete chance. And that was our first project, 44 Stanley Avenue.
Beautiful. And 44 Stanley is one of those places I still love going to. So, Brian, I just want to quickly remind everybody, because your background is actually very, very interesting. I mean, you've got a great eye for identifying those elements which you need to retain and enhance, and then which elements you can get rid of. And that comes from probably your background in photography and working as a TV news cameraman, which was back in the days of the Bang Bang Club, famously in South Africa. And I mean, that must have also given you an idea of what, you know, because people go, oh, the CBD is so dangerous. But in the things that you've done and the places you've been, you understood and experienced real danger. And you know what exaggeration is, don't you?
Yeah, I guess I do. I think, you know, you hit on I always wonder where my love for dereliction comes from. And my mind always goes back to Vukovar, which strangely now Europe's going through the second war in 35 years. But Vukovar was a beautiful city on the Croatian-Serbian front lines. Mm-hmm. And it was completely battered by the Croats and the Serbs, because the Croats were holding it, the Serbs were kind of bashing it. Mm. And I visited it just after it had fallen, and there were these beautiful avenues, these old buildings, but every single one had been kind of shot up and splintered, and every window pane, every gutter, every tree smashed to pieces. And all I could think of was restoring it. Oh, wow. This could be so beautiful. And I think that dereliction kind of stuck in my mind. And the first real opportunity that came up, I kind of worked it until it happened, which was, again, 44 Stanley Avenue. Yeah. Hmm.
Yatish, yeah. I know you would be interested in this too. I mean, just before we even get into the ups and downs of Johannesburg and kind of the inner city and what sort of opportunities it provides, just your thoughts on what's going on now with Ukraine and Russia, because that's on everyone's mind at the moment. And having covered war zones, like you were just saying, in Bosnia and Croatia and Serbia all those years ago, this must be kind of upsetting that we keep making these dumb mistakes and we keep going backwards into war situations when we thought we'd maybe left that behind. Was that naive?
I felt sick when I realized that I actually felt sick because when I woke up when it was last week when they kind of gone that the war had started essentially. Because, you know, everyone loses in a war. It's the most terrible kind of, it's the most terrible place where you see, and you hear these women and women on radio or television, and they are crying and they are completely beside themselves. And you see people sitting at the side of railway lines with their life's possessions. These people are like us. They've just come from their homes. I've seen it. They've just come from their homes. They 10Ks walk away from where they lived, and they've got a few possessions because it's cold now, and that's it. And they don't know where they're going, what's going to happen to their house, what's going to happen to their family, et cetera, et cetera. And it's just a complete mess. Look, we pre-programmed. We will fight with each other forever. But I just think that there's some megalomania and stupidity by Putin starting this thing. And the terrible thing about war is that no one knows where it's going to end. There's no definitive answer. It's not going to be like done in a week. We're going to have the results and off we go. No, this is a big irresponsible thing for the planet at the moment to get into a war. And I don't know, I really feel very kind of very bummed by the whole thing. Terrible.
I knew you'd have some strong views on that. That's why I thought it was probably appropriate before we just move on to all the other stuff to just talk about that a little bit. Now, from being a TV journalist and producer to becoming a property developer seems like a bit of a big leap. And you did explain just now how your experience has kind of put you in a position where you would seek that stuff out in some ways. But you also seem to like old buildings and turning things that are pretty awful into beautiful spaces. I mean, this is an interesting thing to do. How did you discover in South Africa that this is something you wanted to do in a place, for example, like 44 Stanley?
All right. So I used to drive past 44 Stanley every day. I used to have a camera rental business because I was a cameraman and I thought my days off, I could rent out my camera. So the business it was a powerful little business. I say powerful for me. It paid me a decent salary and the people that I employed. Mm-hmm. And I also started an editing company called Gasworks Post, and we worked around the corner. And I knew about the buildings directly to the north of me, but never really did anything about them until my brother-in-law said he wanted to come to Johannesburg. He was moving to Johannesburg, and he wanted to open a bar. Now, to cut a long story short, that bar became the Color Bar, and it became a lot more famous than 44 Stanley Avenue when we started. But I saw these buildings, and I said to the guy, we wanted to rent this space. And the guy said, well, I'm sorry, it's an old mutual property. It's not a core asset. We're shutting it down. We're mothballing it, basically, and we're going to demolish it at some point. And I said to him, without having any money, really, I said, I want to buy it. And I mean, like, oof, the guy looked at me like I was completely fucking nuts. And I kind of went home and I thought about this. And I thought, okay, I'm going to cook up an idea. And the idea that I cooked up was that we agree on a price on the buildings. Then they give me the money to fix those buildings and they don't have to worry about anything. I will find tenants. And that's exactly what we did. And they sold us the buildings for, okay, believe this, 1.6 million rand. And they lent us money to fix the buildings, or we drew the money down as we needed it to fix the buildings once I found the tenants. So, look, it's a little bit more technical than that because you actually had to have the leases signed, but that's how it got going. And it was a fantastic start, and what I saw when I saw these buildings is I walked over the threshold and I thought, okay, we'll start with a bar, but we need a restaurant, we need a shop, we need a this, we need a that. And we basically, I had this vision that it would be something like it is today. It turned out, I think, more beautifully, because you can't kind of imagine the nooks and crannies and trees and gardens and things. But I'm very, very happy with the way it's turned out. It's just a beautiful little, I think it's a bit of a jewel in Johannesburg.
It really is. I love
and exploring.
I love that place. I've been there, you know, especially when I used to work at the SABC. It was like a little oasis in an otherwise quite drab part of town. And it's put energy and life and excitement back into that part of Johannesburg. It's magnificent. Yeah, Tish, you've obviously been there a number of times, right?
I do. I'm actually there more often than I care to admit, Brian, because I live around the corner. So we're often there for chocolates and a coffee.
Good.
One of the things, you know, and I think, you know, the value of space. I mean, so much has been written about the value of space, right? You know, kind of the broken window syndrome. And its role in social cohesion, which I guess is some of the stuff we talk about, right? How public and private can work together to kind of uplift society. And space plays a critical role. Architecture plays a critical role in really providing the infrastructure for people to interact, right? But I suppose one of the things that these sorts of developments often comes up against is you know, the kind of label of gentrification, right? The High Line experienced that in New York, you know, and I'm sure a lot of that criticism exists here. I mean, what's your take on that? How can we, I mean, it's a force for me, and how do you leverage the force to still drive a broader agenda?
Okay, so I love the question. I love the whole gentrification. When people say the word gentrification, it's almost like, oh, we hate that word. Yeah. I love that word. And I'd love to gentrify a lot of areas and areas around where I work. But what the secret, I think, is, and this is where we jump to Victoria Yards, my latest development, is that you gentrify without displacement. So we were very lucky to find this property in a very poor area, surrounded by, you know, a diaspora from Africa, where people's lives were surrounded with filth, with rubbish on the streets, with no attention paid to it by the council, et cetera, et cetera. And we had the opportunity to transform quite a big space in this poor area that could employ people, attract entrepreneurs from the area that we could benefit from, but at the same time that they could benefit from by getting salaries, et cetera. So what we did, salaries and generating a, you know, workflow or a business. So and the idea behind that is that, first of all, people living around the buildings can walk to work. So they, and a lot of people in Victoria Yards actually live, 60% of the people that work in Victoria Yards live within a 15-minute walk from Victoria Yards. No transport costs, no waking up at hideous hours of the morning to get to work. It's kind of work up at a decent time, walk over to work in a secure area, make some money, go home, fix your toilet, fix your roof, carry on living where you're living, because it's easy. It's not the struggle every day. And that, to me, is what I call gentrification without displacement. Perfect. Thank you very much. The kids can walk freely on the streets. Look, you know, it hasn't happened yet, but it's happening.
It's so weird that this gentrification has become like a swear word in development, because I completely agree with everything you've just said, Brian. I'm so sick of, you know, like people who think they know better and also who speak on behalf of poor people they've never spoken to. And they're like, well, I just think what you're doing is you're going in and you're ruining the character of this place by making it better. Like, what kind of insanity is that? I mean, look, for example, at places like the High Line in New York. Don't tell me that anyone would be walking down those streets the way that they've brought life and commerce and excitement to that part of New York, a part of New York which, frankly, you know, it was derelict. It was all the things that we would think of the worst parts of inner cities. I don't understand where all of this comes from, but I don't think it's a good place.
Well, it's you know, the High Line is a beautiful thing. We all love it. It's amazing. But unfortunately, what it did do, that's one of the gentrification projects. It made the properties around the High Line so valuable that there was huge pressure and there was a certain kind of gentrification going on with displacement.
But what a pleasure for those people who've been living there up to then, and if they actually own the property
to be, stay.
Yeah, correct. But I mean, if they can't afford to stay, then you know, that's also part of what happens in cities. It's always in motion. Sometimes a place that someone thought was, I mean, look at Hillbrow back in the 70s. I mean, it was like the, you know, Hillbrow used to be the place to be back in the 70s in Johannesburg. And then it became something completely different.
Different. And the one benefit of the High Line, you know, which was great about that development team, and Brian, you probably know better than us, but they sort of recognized that displacement challenge, and then I think open sourced a lot of their learnings for anybody else who was looking at inner city renewal projects to go, here's what we learned, here's what you can learn, and here's how we think it could be done better next time, which I thought was such a wonderful gesture. And off the back of that point, you know, we've had a lot of guests on the show, guys like Rivonia Circle. We had the sort of Education Trust last week. And a lot of, we've spoken a lot about sort of public-private partnerships as being quite a critical sort of lever for us going forward. And so much, you know, I've seen projects, I know it didn't go ahead, but I've seen projects with the City of Toronto and Google, and that was quite a big undertaking where they engaged public and private. We've seen so much on that sort of 20-minute walking city that's really started to arrive. How have we, I suppose, I mean, have you had any exposure? Have you been engaged by anybody in public service? Is there any concerted effort to bring together sort of private kind of development arms like yourself and sort of typical infrastructure and government work to try to create some of these landmark projects? Especially just to conclude that point, I read a piece the other day about the exodus from Johannesburg. You know, a lot of people moving down to Cape Town for a slightly better quality of life. You can now do things virtually, I guess, and we've experienced that in our own business, to be honest. But what are your thoughts on, or what are your experiences on working with government to create some of these projects and hopefully, you know, rejuvenate some of these pockets?
Do we have a functioning government? I'm just checking.
No.
Anyway, no. Listen, I'm being facetious, but there are definitely. Look, we get involved at very low levels. Victoria Yards, for instance, we've had the roadworks around us kind of sorted out. There's a lot of interest, and they almost feel the responsibility of taking us on because we're doing good for the public. But I do think that public-private involvements are hugely important, and we need to put our heads together because there's so much opportunity in this country to make a huge difference.
Yeah, but
with private public, yes.
But you're a straight shooter too, and let's just be absolutely honest about this. A lot of the time, the government, whether it's municipal, local, council people or whatever, they get in the way. They don't actually help.
Yeah, I mean, look, I'm actually in Burkhart in my little house where I'm kind of gentrifying right now. But
nice, good.
But you know, I'm working on a massive new project in Stellenbosch, and we've met this incredible kind of, I call him the good citizen of Stellenbosch. His name is Hannes van Zyl, and he's with the council in Stellenbosch, and he's a very well known figure. And, you know, we had a meeting with him the other day, and he was talking about putting together a quite a big project across the road from ours. And it would definitely have to be a private-public partnership. There's absolutely no way it could work anyway. So I think it's kind of horses for courses. So in some areas, you're just not going to get it right. In some areas, you are, depending on how progressive and efficient the council or that section of the government is there. You know, obviously you try it in, I don't know, you know what I'm saying.
Yeah. Now there are places where it works and places where, I'm glad that you gave kudos to this Hannes van Zyl guy. I mean, there are unsung heroes and people who do have the best interests of their city, their community at heart. And I think that it's worth mentioning those people. I wanted to ask you though, on a more general basis, what do you think it is, having had the experiences that you've had, and I would say that the success that you've had, not just the experiences, what do you think it is that makes a really good public space? And how do we create spaces that work better? Because sometimes it doesn't have to do with money. Sometimes it doesn't have to do with location. Sometimes it's a combination of a whole bunch of factors. And you must have, in your travels and in your experience in this business that you're in now, done a lot of analysis, even if it's just thinking about it on the way there and on the way back and speaking to people and kind of experiencing the place. What makes a really good location? What makes a really good venue? What makes an interesting public space? And how do some work and others don't?
Okay, so I'm going to chuck us straight back into Victoria Yards again, where there were three pillars to creating Victoria Yards: food security, artisanal workshops, because the very clever government took out vocational training skills from schools, and real and meaningful integration with the people that live in the area. So with those three things, so food security, there was food growing in an environment that people could see. They could see it's easy to grow vegetables instead of grass and roses. Mm. The second thing was an exposure to many people that lived in the area, different artisanal skill sets. So from glass blowing to working with copper to working with wood to, you know, creating art, sculpture, et cetera, et cetera. And then this, what can we, or what can the Makers Valley, which is a partnership within Victoria Yards, do to integrate in meaningful ways with the population? So if you go back quickly to the artisans and the makers, one of the things that I did, and I curate the people coming into my developments, is I say, your product has to be world standard. It has to be able to be sold anywhere in the world because it's excellent. So who does that attract? That attracts the people, the Lanis from over the hill.
Yeah.
So the people from the north are coming over the hill to buy stuff in Victoria Yards. The people are coming to sell food to those people that are visiting Victoria Yards. So you've got now, you're mashing these people together without them even realizing it. So you've got the poor artisan or the guy that doesn't have the cash to chuck around. And the common factor with all of this, I believe, is dignity. If you can bring people across the threshold that are good people, they're just good people and they're clean people and they've got something to give, you can mash them up with anyone you want. It's when you're not going to get the guys, the pickers, kind of coming to Victoria Yards because they just can't afford to. But you are going to get a whole bunch of different people coming together and not saying, well, I've got a lot of money, you don't. What do we say? Why are we sitting at the same table together? Mm. There's this lovely, pure kind of interest that comes from people generally. They just like being together. If you can create the environment where they all feel comfortable, and I think that's what we've done.
Yeah, see, I mean, I love that thinking because it just, you know, it connects so much with the guest we had last week who dealt with education, but the more you spoke to her, the more you realized she actually dealt with the factors around education, right? Community factors. And even just listening to you now on Victoria Yards and your approach, you know, the architecture is almost secondary, I hate to say that, but it sounds like it is, to the sort of challenges you're solving at a local level, whether that's food security or sort of upskilling from a labor perspective. So yeah, I think there's is that what you're taking into Stellenbosch? Is that a similar approach? Because I understand it's in Marcus Huster's old office, speaking of derelict buildings.
Well, it's a very big project. It's 170,000 square meters, and it's similar, but it's got a lot of residential, which is another kind of factor to what Victoria Yards is, because we don't really have residential, and it's not as socially aligned because it's right as you enter Stellenbosch.
Mm-hmm.
But there was you kind of knocked me off my thread because there was something very important that I wanted to mention. But thanks, you kind of knocked it off my out of my little.
No, I mean the Stellenbosch thing sounds amazing. But we were talking about communities and how the architecture is secondary, and it might have had something to do with that.
Oh yes, thank you. So you say the buildings and the architecture is secondary. Absolutely not. I believe everyone, without even acknowledging it, loves aesthetics. If you put it, if you put somebody, okay, just picture this guy sitting on top of a rubbish dump sniffing rubber burning, or put him in a garden, where's he going to feel better?
Of course.
Hello.
Yeah.
So you have to bring aesthetics into everything. And it's a very interesting point, because the Dr. Simon Mason, the guy that did his thesis on Victoria Yards, he was the guy that approached me to start Maker's Valley. And we took him in, we gave him 100 square meters, and he built it into an organization that is well known now, that raises lots of funds and gets integrated with the public. He was like, aesthetics, yeah, it's not important. Let's fill stomachs. I said, it is very important, because people really respond to a beautiful environment.
Absolutely.
End of story.
Yeah, you know, I mean, if I think about how many people during the last 2.5 years with Corona and everything have suddenly become aware of their own surroundings in a very, very powerful way. I mean, for example, the fact that your house has for many people also become your office, the fact that for many people they were stuck at home, even if that isn't their office, even if they did have to leave and work. The fact that they were perhaps confined to their house for a certain amount of that time made people suddenly pay attention to things which architects are always paying attention to. You know, the layout, the amount of space, the use of that space, the utility, that beautiful spot, the sweet spot you find between the aesthetics that you're talking about and the function. I think that's really the most, that's the sexiest thing in the world. I mean, I'm a frustrated architect. And when we talk about these things, when you just mentioned it now, I get so excited about the fact that people, no matter where they come from, what they have, what they don't have, what they do for a living, what they speak, none of that stuff seems to matter. Everybody has some appreciation for beauty, for clean lines, for simplicity, for a space that is warm and welcoming, as opposed to a space that is cold and industrial and ugly.
No question. And we need it. It's kind of, we need it. Subconsciously, we need to be surrounded by beauty. I learned a lot from my wife. She would not take an ugly fucking route anywhere. She would always kind of go the pretty route, the trees,
magic,
whatever. And I've kind of started doing it. It's a fantastic way to take life in, because if you're clouded with ugliness, then you've got, you just kind of,
that's your reality.
A bit messy, you know.
Yeah, that's your reality then.
Yeah. And Stephen Fry says this thing about, because someone once quizzed him about, why do you use Apple products? They're not particularly useful, they're just beautiful. And he said, no, you twit. Like, beauty is the most useful thing you can get, because if it's prettier, I use it more. And the more I use it, the more useful it is to me. So there's that.
No,
absolutely
vital. Yeah.
Well, we couldn't end it on a better note than that. And Brian, it's so good to have you on. One of these days, we're going to have to go and delve back into your history with war zones and cameras and things. But for this morning, it was great to have your input on these tremendously interesting subjects. And I hope we'll see you again soon. Keep doing the good work.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Yeah, Tish,
cheers,
we will
Brian.
See you next week for another episode of This Is Us. Stick around.
Perfect. Cheers, everybody.
Cheers, bye-bye. Everybody. Bye-bye. CliffCentral.com.